Menopause, perimenopause, these can be some of the most uncomfortable phases of a woman's life. If you find yourself in either of these, well, Hormone Harmony is here for you. Hormone Harmony capsules contain science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life.
Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it really shows.
And get this, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it is perfect for those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold.
And for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DRESSED at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DRESSED for 15% off today.
Dress, the History of Fashion, is a production of iHeartRadio. Over 7 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dressed, the History of Fashion, a podcast where we explore the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, April Callahan
and Cassidy Zachary.
Today, Dressed listeners, we are so happy to bring you part one of a very special two-part episode on the fashion history of the kimono. And this episode has been on our list of ideas and our working list, which is ever growing and ever increasing. Basically, it's been on the list since day one.
I know. If Dress listeners could see the list of episodes we have, I mean, the show will go on forever if you let us. And I have to say, I am actually glad that we waited to do this episode because the Victoria and Albert Museum, they just put out an exhibition earlier this year, Kimono Kyoto to Catwalk, and it provides just the sort of deep dive into the topic that we love to do on Dressed, hence the two-part episode.
Featuring 315 garments, Kimono Kyoto to Catwalk represents the UK's first major exhibition on kimono. Unfortunately, the pandemic has meant that the Victoria and Albert, like so many other institutions around the world, is closed at the moment, and also this incredible exhibition with it, which is why we are all the more thrilled to welcome today's guest to the show.
Right, because if we cannot currently go see the exhibition, why not bring the exhibition or at least its curator's insights and expertise to us, right? So today we are very excited to have Anna Jackson joining us on the show. Anna is the head of the Asian department at the V&A and specializes not only in Japanese dress and fashion, but the cultural exchanges that have happened for centuries between Japan and Europe.
Anna, welcome to Dressed.
Anna, welcome to Dressed. It is such a pleasure to have you here with us today.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
So Kimono Kyoto to Catwalk, the exhibition and accompanying catalog are tremendous feats of scholarly inquiry and research into the kimono, its history, the artistry and techniques that comprise its construction, and then, of course, its influence around the world. So I'm really curious to know what inspired this exhibition and why is it so important?
Well, thank you very much. Well, I've been looking after the collection of Japanese textiles and dress at the V&A for many years. So it's kind of an idea that's sort of been percolating in my head for quite a while. But I think, as you probably know, the V&A is really famous for its fashion exhibitions. But they've inevitably focused on Western fashion and famous designers. And really, we wanted to show that fashion flourished elsewhere in the world. And I think there's a tendency to see kimono and people recognize they're very beautiful, but they tend to see them as sort of timeless, unchanging costume. So we really wanted to show that they were fashionable. It's all about fashion in Japan and always has been. And really to show as well that you may think of a kimono as being quintessentially Japanese, but it has had an enormous impact on fashions around the world. I think for doing it now, there's been in the last few years last decade or so, quite a fashion, a sort of kimono renaissance in Japan. And I notice that more and more when I visit the country myself. So it seemed like a really opportune moment to investigate the kimono and present it. And also we were conscious that it's Olympic year, though the Olympics have now been put back, it was Olympic year. So it seemed like a good moment when people might be thinking about Japan and be interested to know more about Japanese culture.
Yeah, and in the exhibition, you have kimono presented in the traditional flat two-dimensional display, but you also have kimono, from the photographs I've seen, displayed on mannequins, so in the round. And this really is not something that you typically see. So I'm curious what inspired this decision, because I think it's really, really important.
Yeah, it's quite unusual. I think I'm not sure I've seen it done before with historic garments. The thing about kimono is it's a very, if you think about the kimono, the most obvious thing about it is it's this completely straight cut garment that is wrapped simply around the body. And it's so very different from how you think about fashion in the West, where you've got clothes that sort of accentuate or suppress different aspects of your body. And in Japan, there's no relationship between the body and the dress. It's all about what's happening on the surface of the cloth. You know, what's the pattern? You know, how is it decorated and so on? So the best way to see kimono really is on those kind of T-bar kind of stands. It's also the case that because they're wrapped around with an obi, the sash that goes around the middle, and with undergarments. And whereas the kimono survive, the obi and the undergarments don't usually. So we don't necessarily have those historic things to accurately clothe a body. And also, of course, kimono inherently quite fragile, some of them. So you don't want to damage them by sort of tying them across the waist. So for all those reasons, you tend to see them on these sort of T-bar flat. But the disadvantage of that is that you see them as works of art and you don't see them as clothes. So really what we wanted to do was to make people understand that they're clothes and how different they look on the body. And we can do that a little bit through the paintings and the prints that we show in the exhibition, but we really wanted to try to put them on the mannequin. Now, obviously that's easier when you get to the present day when the garments are more robust, but it's more difficult with historic garments. But kimono, as I mentioned, were worn in layers. So in the winter months, sort of elite members of society would wear an outer kimono known as an uchikake, which kind of hangs. It doesn't have the obi. It hangs a bit like an open coat with a big thick hem. So we decided we would do it with these garments because then you don't have to worry about the tying. We still wanted to get it right historically. We still have to do it very carefully. So it's quite a challenge that I set the conservators and the mounters in who work at the B&A with me to do this very well. And they made wonderful sort of underpinnings and undergarments to support these, and sort of cushions at the back that look like the obi underneath and so on. And we had wigs made just to try and make it look very realistic. And right at the very end, we had a colleague come over from Japan, Koko Yoshimura, who works for Bunkyo Gakuen, one of the big fashion colleges and museums in Japan, in Tokyo. And she helps us just to make sure we were getting everything historically accurate, because obviously we wanted to get it right. So it was quite an interesting experience and quite fun. It was quite challenging. And I think it was quite a surprise to Japanese who'd seen it, including Ms. Yoshimura. When I asked her, how would this be done in Japan? She said, this is never done in Japan ever. she thought it was, I looked at her, I said, do you think they've done it wrong? She said, no, not at all. I think it's really exciting, but it's very, very unusual. It is quite a challenge. But it does make you look at the garments quite differently. And what was quite amusing, I hope you won't mind me saying, but one of our big lenders, David Halimi, he came to the first instance in the show where you see this with a samurai woman's garment. He said, gosh, that's a really beautiful kimono. Who owns that? And I went, you do. And it was because he said, oh my goodness, because it was so different to see it in that way.
Yeah.
And he was, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I said, no, it just proves how different you look at it and how different, because you don't sort of focusing so much on the pattern, you're focusing on the shape. So it was a really, really interesting and quite challenging thing to get right and to make sure, again, that we weren't damaging the garments. But I think it really brought the garments to life for people.
Absolutely. And I can only imagine, as a museum goer going there to see that, it really helps you, you kind of imagine the woman or the man that would have worn that garment.
And obviously, as you get closer to the present day, in the last section of the show, I think virtually every kimono is on a mannequin. And actually, when we do the 1920s garments, we put a few of those on the mannequins. And that was quite fun as well, because we went shopping in Tokyo to vintage stores with Ms. Yoshimura, who I mentioned, to make sure we were, again, getting the accessories that were the right for the kimono, and not just to get the right period, but just to get the right kind of style. So I kept picking things, and she said, no, that's far too tasteful, Anna. You have to remember that they love the clashing colours. So she picked out, for ones we've got with amazing sort of striped and sort of arrows on it, sort of strong green and black colour. She picked one that was sort of pink with kind of like carnation-like flowers on it. And I thought, oh, that's just, that's a bit, you know, not weird. But actually, of course, when it was all, when she came and she dressed it, all it looked brilliant. It was absolutely perfect for the period. That was from the 1920s.
So as you've kind of mentioned, the exhibition covers hundreds of years of Japanese fashion, the progression of fashion. I'm hoping you can take us back and kind of to the basics a little bit. Can you basically just tell us what the kimono is and a bit about its early development in Japanese societies? Because for starters, the moniker kimono, I believe, was not applied universally to this type of garment until the 19th century.
Yeah, the kimono just simply means the thing to wear. And although you could see instances of the word being used much earlier in Japanese history, it isn't really till the 19th century that the word gets sort of used as this sort of umbrella term. And the correct term really for garments, particularly sort of pre that period, is normally kosode, which means small sleeve, which is referring to the opening at the wrist. And then you get other kinds of words like furisode, which means long sleeves. So there's quite a lot of influence on sleeves. And really, it was just when Japan encountered the West in the 19th century, when all those sort of subtleties of Japanese dress were rather thrown out of the window, they started to use kimono as this sort of umbrella term. But we used it throughout the show because obviously it's a word people are familiar with. And it has quite a long history in the sort of what's known as the Heian period. So in the sort of 10th and 11th century, the kimono-like form seems to have been used as an undergarment for much more elaborate and wide-sleeved garments worn at court. But gradually there was a sort of change in society with the falling out of power of the imperial household, the rise of the samurai, a simplification of dress, and this kind of garment seemed to rise to the surface almost. And at the same time, you've got the sort of clothing of commoners, which was much more simple and quite sort of kimono-like in shape. So gradually these things sort of came together. And really by the 16th century, the garment that we would think of today as a kimono had become the principal garment for everyone to wear, regardless of their position in society. And it was worn by both sexes. We tend to think of it as a feminine garment, but men wore kimono as well, and indeed children.
And can you talk a little bit about the construction of the kimono? Because it's so different than European and American tailoring techniques. I mean, it's really cut from one width of cloth.
That's right. One bolt of cloth cut very simply. So you just get a one length that goes so from hem to hem on each side. There's never a seam across the shoulder in a kimono. And then you get another section of cloth that's just the sleeve. And then a sort of thinner section that's the overlap, as it's wrapped around the body, and then another bit for the collar. So it is very, very simple. It's not about tailoring as we think of it in the West. So it is, as I say, the very straight seams. And in the exhibition, in the B&A, in fact, we have a, rather unusually, we have a sort of deconstructed kimono, something that we acquired in the early 20th century. And I think it must have been shown sort of in exhibitions to explain this to people. It's just the flat bits of cloth. It's all, they have all the decoration, but you can see the different sections, which is quite good. And then we had our AV designers, Luke Halls, were able to make a little video, which I hope might be available online at some point, where you can actually see how these pieces come together to make the garment. So it was really the surface that was important. So what kind of materials you used, what kind of decorative techniques, what kind of colours and so on, and motifs that were really important. That's what told people sort of who you were and what your style was.
Yeah, and I want to get into that a little bit more in a minute here. But first, I want to talk about the emergence of the Japanese fashion system. This is one of the cornerstones of your exhibition. And one of the most important things of your exhibition, I have to say, that you're actively countering, as you said earlier, those Eurocentric narratives that really say that fashion and the fashion system only evolved in Europe and America. And you've proven through this exhibit that that simply was not true. So you actually say that this emerges in the Edo period, which had, you know, political stability and economic growth. So how did that foster this Japanese fashion system?
Well, after sort of, well, centuries really of sort of civil unrest and civil war, Japan was unified at the beginning of the 17th century by a great samurai leader, Tokugawa Ieyasu, and he chose for his new capital what was essentially quite a small It wasn't even a town at that stage. It was Edo, which is what we call Tokyo today, and that's where the name of the period comes from. And this was just, you know, there was really unprecedented political stability in the few hundred years that followed. And with that came prosperity and the growing demand for goods and the sort of growing sort of wealth of quite a lot of Japanese inhabitants. Not everybody, of course, but there was a sort of, and certainly a sort of growth in urbanization. It was, you know, Edo, present-day Tokyo, went from being this sort of small fishing village to being the biggest city in the world. It had over a million inhabitants by the beginning of the 18th century, so it was about four times the size of London at that stage. So what you see kind of emerging particularly, though the samurai, who are no longer fighting, so they were no longer having to prove themselves on the battlefield, for them it was all about sumptuous appearances. So they were very important consumers of luxury kimono. But it was really the merchant classes. Japan had quite a strict social hierarchy at the time with samurai, the samurai class. We tend to think of samurai as the sort of warriors in armor, but they were sort of ruling military aristocracy, if you like. So samurai class at the top, then the farmers, and then the artisans, and then the merchants at the bottom. And they were seen as a bit of a necessary evil. They just benefited from the labors of others. And they were the ones who got rich. So they were the ones who really sort of became really important consumers of the kimono. They were the ones who demanded the newest styles. And what, when we look at sort of fashion in Japan, or, you know, what is it that makes something fashion, a fashion system, as you mentioned, rather than just sort of like changing styles? And people often date it to sort of the 1660s, and this is when pattern books were first produced. So taking advantage of the sort of newly developed woodblock printing styles, these sort of books that would have about 100 pages of patterns or for kimono. So the outline, usually the outline of the back of a kimono, showing the design with some hints on what colors or what techniques you could use, sometimes interspersed with images of women wearing fashionable kimono. And these were produced in their thousands. And you could go to a merchant, to a kimono store to get one of these, or you could just go to a normal bookshop. Sometimes you bought them, or you could sort of just borrow them. And people read them in the way that we might read modern magazines, just to get inspiration about what to wear. And they became a way of communicating with the merchants as well about what kind of styles you want. So this is a way that sort of information about fashion circulated. And certainly woodblock prints themselves were very, very important, particularly as you got into the 18th and 19th century, when colour woodblock printing developed. And you get this amazing, beautiful prints of gorgeous-looking women or famous courtesans or kabuki actors in these very colourful prints. And we think of those prints now. If you wanted to buy some of these famous prints now, they would cost you thousands of pounds or dollars. But at the time, they were just completely ephemeral. They were really cheap. They apparently cost one sheet print would cost you about the same as a couple of helpings of noodles, and noodles were the cheapest form of food in Japan at the time. So these, again, it was how fashion circulated. So in the same way that we read magazines today or look online or whatever the latest fashion. So this is how you see a sort of fashion system kind of developing. And certainly you get the importance of people who led fashion, like famous courtesans, like kabuki actors. Everyone would want to dress like their favorite actor, just again something similar to today. And they'd go out and buy the, you know, if an actor was on stage wearing the latest sort of colors or a new shade or a new pattern, all his fans would want to go out and buy something, get something that was similar. So it's quite a lot of fed by that kind of celebrity culture. There were kimono retailers and makers and the print people who produced the prints and the books. They kind of exploiting this latest demand. So it is very much like a fashion system as we think of it today. And certainly in the way that the shops were established, the most famous shop is probably Echigoya, which is what evolved into the present-day Mitsukoshi department store, founded in 1673 by Mitsui Takatoshi, who really understood the power of the brand. So apparently, if you went to his shop when it was raining, he'd give you an umbrella with his crest, with his logo on it. And there was a famous incident in Edo where all three of the most popular theatres, the actors, all stopped to talk about how wonderful his fashions were. So a real sort of marketing campaign, as we would think of it now. So that all these things that seem to us very modern were in fact around in Edo period Japan.
Yeah, and you've talked a little bit about it. You've said about this industry that really rose up to meet the demands of this increasingly fashion-conscious population. And really, that print culture served to kind of democratize fashion too, right, across that kind of the economic spectrum. So many people could afford. As you said, it was as inexpensive as a couple bowls of ramen. So people who might not have been able to participate in fashion prior could now, because of this wealth of availability.
I mean, it wasn't necessary that everyone was wealthy. I think it's important to remember that most people would wear something quite simple on a day-to-day level. They'd wear a cotton kimono or something simply striped. You just wear the silk kimono for special events. And if you weren't very wealthy, you wouldn't be able to afford a silk kimono necessarily. And obviously, it's like the haute couture of the day and things that survive in museums.
Absolutely.
Such as the V&A. But so you'd look at your famous courtesan or your actor, and you wouldn't, it's a bit like today, you know, we can't go out and buy or afford to go out and buy designer clothes, but you know, hopefully we get something vaguely similar on the high street. So it was kind of similar to that, you know, it was just something to sort of beam about, to emulate. If you were lucky enough, you'd be able to buy something occasionally to copy your favorite actor or something.
Those woodblock print publications that you're talking about, they're works of art in their own right. They're so incredibly beautiful when you look at them. You know, we're talking like hand-painted and stenciled. They're incredibly beautiful. And then what I loved about the catalog is that you have, in some instances, you're able to match an extant kimono in your collection with a woodblock print that someone took inspiration from. And I just find that incredibly, it's wonderful.
Yes, that took a while sometimes to do that. But yeah, it was very, it's a very nice way of doing it. And in the exhibition as well, we use the prints really as a sort of inspiration. So we've got a couple of the prints showing kimono, a woman getting dressed with her makeup in front of her and a mirror and makeup brushes and combs, and with a rack of kimono behind her and everything. And in the show, we've rather than putting something on the normal kimono stand, we've got a kimono rack, and we've sort of draped kimono of it over it. And we've got in our collection, it's not in the catalogue, I'm afraid, beautiful lacquer mirror, and we've got some of these combs and brushes, so we've laid them out. So we've used the prints really as a sort of inspiration for the displays.
And so you mentioned haute couture earlier, and certainly these kimonos span the spectrum of inexpensive to incredibly expensive. There's a really wonderful part in the exhibition catalog where you kind of go through the process of what it would have been like for, say, a wealthy woman, the wife of a wealthy merchant, to procure her wardrobe. And I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit about what that process might have been like, and then also the social expectations she would have had to consider when doing so.
So if you were, you would tend to order kimono twice a year, and it's a bit like the seasons now, the fashion season. So in the summer, you would order winter kimono, and in the winter, you would order your summer wardrobe. And you would go to the merchants. So the merchants were kind of like at the apex of the sort of network of artisans who would make kimono. So they would. So you'd either go to the merchant yourself, or perhaps if you were very rich, of course, you'd send one of your servants to do this. Or indeed, someone from the merchant house might come to you. From the kimono shop might come to you to talk about it. And using the woodblock prints, using the pattern books, you would talk through what kind of things you might like. And then with your order, the kimono merchant would sort of start the process. It could take a few months to make a very sumptuous garment, or perhaps about a month or a few weeks to make something that was very, very much more simple. So first of all, once the cloth had been woven, so you'd choose a particular kind of cloth, the cloth had been woven, the kimono would be sort of temporarily constructed. The design would be drawn on it with a sort of soluble kind of ink, and then the kimono would be taken apart again, and it would go to different workshops for different parts of the decoration. So the dyeing would be done in one workshop, say, and the embroidery in another. Sometimes it's just created with dyeing or just with embroidery. But if there was a combination, these things would move from workshop to workshop, each time going back to the merchant, who would check that the work was well done. And at the end, all the parts would be sent to the kimono maker, who would sew everything together and add the linings and any kind of padding. In the winter, you would have a sort of slight silk padding in the garment to make them warmer and so on. And then again, at each point, the work would be checked off until it was finally ready for delivery. And the merchant would keep a very careful check on all the costs that were involved in making the garment. And then they would add a 30% for their own profit at the end. And that would be the final bill that would go to you. So as the consumer, and I think, you know, very wealthy people might order sort of 30 kimono at a time, if they were very wealthy. And, you know, I suppose the kimono would reflect your wealth, you know, depending on how much money you had to spend on these garments, you know, whether you could choose the finest silk or the most beautifully woven examples, or whether you would have to, whether you have embroidery, or whether you would have something cheaper like stenciling, for example. And also your age. So younger women, for example, would wear what are known as furosori, swinging sleeves, these very long sleeves. You have them cut shorter when you're younger. And younger women, a bit like now, I suppose, you know, you'd have the most colourful and the most bold designs tended to be for a younger generation. Older women would wear something a little bit more subtle, a bit quieter, if you like, in design. And certainly men as well would tend to wear much more sort of understated colours, less patterning and so on. So there were those kind of considerations. And actually your own sophistication and taste, you know, sometimes you'd have kimono designs that would refer to famous poems or other kind of references to literature and things, and you might want to show off how erudite you were by having that kind of design on your kimono. So it would reflect your wealth, it would reflect perhaps your gender, it would reflect your age, and it would reflect your own sort of tastes and cultural sensibilities.
And then also your familial lineage, right? Can you tell us a little bit about the moon? Because that's not something we're really familiar with.
So it's a bit like a crest. So each, it's a circular device. I suppose we think of it most, we associate it most with samurai. So each samurai family would have a mon, a crest. And this is the kind of thing that originally would have been used in battle. So somebody would have the sort of banner with the crest on, so you'd know exactly where your friends were as opposed to your enemies in battle. A bit like having a battle standard now. So that's sort of the origin of these things. But you would also put them on your garments. The samurai men particularly would have the crest of the family. So if you think about each sort of regional lord, effectively they're like a big clan. They all essentially belong to the same sort of extended family. They owe their allegiance to their lord. So if you were, you would have your lord's lord's crest on your garments, and women would as well as men. But really by the Edo period, the period where we sort of focus on at the beginning of the exhibition, you know, more and more people were using these. I mean, certainly famous courtesans would have them. Shops like the Echigoya had its own crest, had its own mon, and it was a way of sort of showing who you were and what family you had. And it's a bit like you'd recognize someone's logo now, you know, for what you bought, but you'd also have them on your garments. So for a very formal garment, worn perhaps for a special occasion or something like a New Year's celebration, you might have five mon, so three along the back, sort of along the shoulder line, and two at the front, or less formal would have three, or sort of semi-formal would just have one.
So you mentioned earlier that kimono is or can be a reflection of your social class, and we witness in various countries across Europe, kind of around the same time, the 16th and 17th century, when we also see a fashion system evolving in Europe. I made a lot of parallels here. When you see the introduction of a fashion system into Japan, you see strict sumptuary laws as a result of that, because they're really trying to dictate just what a person of a certain class could and could not wear, because more and more people could afford to wear clothing that maybe could hide their station or reveal them to be above a station that they were not. So can you talk a little bit about these sumptuary laws and in what ways they were subverted, if at all?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the shogun particularly, the sort of military ruler of Japan and that sort of samurai class, it was all about preserving the status quo, which in a sense preserved their system of power. So the idea was, you know, you had this very, very strict hierarchy, and you would only be able to wear certain clothes, or indeed use other kinds of implements, you know, have certain kinds of lacquer or certain kinds of ceramics and so on, if you are a certain class. And you certainly, it would seem to be dangerous for the system of government if people's dress was getting out of step with their social status. So every now and again, the shogunate would issue sumptuary laws or particular edicts, and that would outlaw particular kinds of, often, you know, it meant that if you were from the merchant classes, you weren't supposed to wear silk, or perhaps you weren't supposed to use the most expensive dyes. Red dye particularly was very popular and very expensive. You weren't allowed to use embroidery, for example. And so they weren't always the same laws, they didn't always say the same thing, but they would always outlaw certain kinds of certainly of fabrics and techniques that were being used. So people would often sort of observe the rules for a certain amount of time, and then they would just get very lax. So you get this kind of move between sort of opulence and restraint in Japanese dress across the Edo period. But certainly often people just completely ignored the rules. They were sometimes known as the three-day laws, because that was the idea that you just, you know, you observe them 3 days and you just forgot about them and you dressed however you like. But they certainly did usher in a certain kinds of changes. So the outlawing, for example, about things about using a lot of gold thread, gold for embroidery, and gold would always look particularly good against a dark ground. So then you've got to move towards paler colours. And certainly it's a very important one, it's a very important sort of technique that's developed in the Edo period. It's known as Yuzen, which is named after the artist who was supposedly invented it. And it was used a rice paste that you you squeezed out of a tube. It's a bit like icing a cake. And you drew effectively with a sort of ribbon of the starch paste across the surface of the cloth. And then you washed the dyes on in between. So effectively, you could just draw anything you liked on a kimono. But essentially, Yuzen was cheaper than using embroidery. And certainly, instead of the shibori, the minute tie-dyeing, people would use stencils to imitate the tie-dyeing. So there are ways that people sort of get around the sumptuary laws by using sort of slightly cheaper versions that would create the same effect on their garments. But there's also sort of other things that people spurted it. So though there was a rule about your kimono, there was no rule about your undergarments or your lining. So there was quite a lot of sort of developments of interesting lining. Men particularly, not only the sumptuary laws, but clothing conventions in Japan at the time dictated that men would wear quite, as I said, quite plain kind of garments, just sort of, you know, very nice, subtly woven or something. So they used to wear their jackets, haori jackets, like kimono-style jackets, which often have quite a flamboyant, quite bright lining, which they would never be seen while being worn. So only the wearer and perhaps a few of his friends would know. But somehow it was that kind of idea of the sort of hidden pattern or hidden luxury. But the interesting thing about is particularly about the colour red. The red colour was seen, was very, very fashionable. It was associated with sort of sensuality and glamour and youth. And it was kind of driven underground. And it became much more fashionable to have your the red as an undergarment or as a lining, because then it would only be glimpsed. It would be glimpsed at the neck or at the hem as a woman walked along or at her sleeve length. And that was seen as far more alluring and far more sexy, if you like, than having this sort of overt display of this sort of the colour red. And this kind of aesthetic was known as icky, which is sometimes translated as sort of sophisticated chic. And it was anybody who had any taste would turn to these kind of subtle details. So it really kind of shows the creativity of sort of a fashion conscious world, that they would sort of, rather than just capitulate to the rules, that they would subvert them in rather interesting and in rather ingenious ways.
Yeah, and I have to say, I actually worked with a private collection a couple of years ago, and they probably had 500 haori. And they are, I have to say, being able to look in at these haori that by any other account are just a kind of like a black jacket. You open up the inside, and there's entire paintings on the interior of these garments. It's absolutely incredible, and you never would have known.
Were these from the sort of 1920s and 30s, though? These are the ones that tend to survive. Were the haori you're looking at, were they Edo period ones, or were they?
Some of them, I would say they did. I think the oldest we had was probably early 1800s.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She had quite the collection. And so obviously there is a progression into the 20th century. But I just, this idea that you would have this entire piece of art in a garment that maybe yourself and your wife would have seen, is just, it's an incredible concept and quite beautiful.
And obviously, you're lucky to have seen things, because they don't often, men's garments, because they're not so lavish on the outside, tend not to survive quite so much. So it's great when you are able to see these things.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned it a little bit, but fashion is nothing without the skilled artisans who've made its production possible throughout history and all over the world. It's especially impressive in the pre-industrialized era, when so much of this was just done painstakingly by hand. I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit more about the techniques, but first, can you tell us about the artists and artisans who participated in the making of kimono? I don't think there were necessarily renowned fashion designers per se, but I believe there were quite a few famous artists.
Mm. Well, we don't, sadly, as you're right, that the names of the people who produced these garments are not known to us today. Certainly in terms of producing the pattern, the original sort of concept of the garments, there are some instances where famous artists designed or literally painted onto the cloth of kimono. So we have one example in the exhibition by Matsumura Goshen, who was a sort of literati artist. So he painted sort of in the style of sort of Chinese monochrome landscape painters. But he did create a garment which we've been able to borrow from Japan. And certainly for some of the kimono books, the pattern books, they some of them are by known artists. We have one on the show by Tsukunobu, who's quite well known for his paintings and his printmaking, but also for his kimono designs. And others of the pattern books have the names of the authors of the book, the designers of the book. They're not names we know today. We haven't been able to find that much biographical information about them, but it's quite possible they were relatively well known at the time. But certainly the artisans who produced the garments, a bit perhaps like today, we don't necessarily know their names or remember their names, but certainly they were very skilled. I mean, the garments we are made in Kyoto, although you tend to think of Edo, the big new bustling capital, as the place of consuming of these garments. I mean, obviously anywhere in lots of places around Japan, you know, which the elite would acquire kimono, but they actually tend to be made in Kyoto. So there were a concentration of skilled labor there for the people who were the weavers, as I mentioned, and the dyers and the embroiderers. So and people would sort of be sometimes quite secretive about their methods. So particular dye houses, the associated particular dye houses that might create a wonderful a new shade, they wouldn't allow that recipe to go out of the workshop, you know, as it became very popular. And it was quite remarkable the number, the range of colours and shades that could be created out of a fairly limited number of plants that would create the colours. So the vegetable dyes on the whole, occasionally mineral pigments. So they would, you know, combine these different dyes to create particular kinds of shades. So you're very skilled. A lot of experimentation went on really to know, you know, how best to dye, how long you need to use the dye stuff for, what mordants you might use, the mordants you use to fix the dye. These were incredibly skilled. And of course, there's also the broiders who would, the threads would be dyed with these wonderful colours as well. And very, very skillful embroidery with tiny needles. And even the other kinds of artisans, we forget, the people who made the threads. So the gold thread, for example, which is a thread that's made of a silk core wrapped in paper, wrapped in gold. You know, there were some artisans whose pure skill was to create that thread. And then people who were the stencil cutters. And then the people who made the tools from which the stencils were cut. So this is an enormous sort of network of artisans. You know, fashion was really big business, and it did support this entire network of people who contributed to it.
Yeah, and I think you write actually in the catalog that the Edo period is when you've mentioned a couple of these different decorative techniques, that it really reached their peak of sophistication during this period because of all of this output and all of this work that went into supporting this fashion system and producing all of these garments. Can you tell us a little bit more about the shibori tie-dye technique specifically?
Yeah, so shibori is a method by which you either bind or clamp or somehow sort of conceal, if you like, parts of the cloth before you dye it. So tie dyeing is usually how it's translated into English, although tie dye is a bit more of a limited kind of technique, we think of it in the West. So if you had, for example, a big area of cloth that you didn't want to dye, you would stitch around that area and gather it together. And then you might bind up that bit that's being gathered. But there's a bit we tend to think of as shibori very particularly is what's known as kaneko shibori. So fawn spot shibori, fawn as in a deer. So this tiny, tiny sort of dappled. And they were really remarkable garments because you see these garments and they just look like they've got tiny spots on them. But each of these little spots represents where the cloth, the silk cloth, has been very, very carefully bound up with silk thread, usually leaving a little tiny bit at the top that's unsheathed, if you like, or unwrapped. And then it's all dipped in the dye bath. So you can use dyes in different ways. You can either paint them on, like with the Yuzen technique, brush them on, or you can do immersion dyeing. So you put the whole cloth into a vat of the colour. And that's often what you do with the red colour, for example. And so then you have to, once you've dyed it and allowed it to dry, you have to very, very carefully snip those little bindings of silk off to create the pattern. So it was a really quite labour-intensive, quite difficult technique. So again, that was very expensive. It's very expensive. And to have a whole garment patterned with shibori was incredibly expensive.
Yeah, and like you said, you cannot emphasize enough how tiny those little bound periods are, because even just looking at it, you don't notice until you look up close and it's like, wow, that entire pattern is created by shibori.
Yes. So it is quite remarkable. I can't imagine what happens to people's eyesight doing this, you know, these sort of terribly tiny sort of skilled work. But, you know, I think, you know, with this sort of demand for the latest styles, people wanted the best. So, you know, you'd get that sort of sense that workshops were really pushing themselves, you know, to have the, you know, they were the best workshop. They had created the latest, you know, they were known for their best styles. They were known for the best techniques. You know, you can imagine that it sort of pushed people on really to experiment with new techniques and really create, you know, the best kind of work they could, because obviously that would be most profitable for the workshop.
Yeah, and to just be able to go back and spend one day there during any of these periods and have seen how colorful and beautiful this bustling, you know, city would have been, it's just incredible to imagine.
Yeah, and then, of course, every kimono you see, really, they're all individual garments. I mean, later on in the 20th century, of course, you know, you get things that are made sort of more, not necessarily mass-produced, but they're made with stencils, so you can produce them the same pattern over and over again. But these kind of really expensive haute couture kind of garments, you know, each one is completely individual. Even though they may have been inspired originally by a pattern, they don't ever really see the same one twice. The range of styles and patterns, it's extraordinary.
Absolutely incredible.
Dress listeners, whatever your reason for wanting to learn a new language, whether it's an upcoming international adventure, communicating with your friends and family abroad, or even professional purposes, Rosetta Stone has got you covered.
As the trusted expert in language learning for 30 years now, you can join millions of Rosetta Stone users to learn any of the 25 languages offered. That includes Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, and so many more.
And this is fast language acquisition, friends. There are no English translations, so you learn to speak, listen, and think in your new language. And right now, you can get lifetime access to all 25 of Rosetta Stone's language courses for 50% off. That's language learning for 25 languages for the rest of your life, which, Cass, is frankly amazing.
It is. And what are you waiting for, dress listeners? Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, dress listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Dress listeners, did you know that you can save on everything from fashion to beauty, home decor to groceries, even kids' school supplies with Rakuten?
Rakuten is a shopping platform that partners with over 3,500 stores across every category. Beauty, clothing, electronics, home, department stores, pets, you name it. You're already shopping at your favorite stores, so why not be saving while doing it? It really is a no-brainer.
How does it work, you ask? Well, stores pay Rakuten a commission for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the commission with its members. You get paid via a check or PayPal quarterly.
Membership is free and it's easy to sign up. So join the 17 million members who have already saved at their favorite brands. Start all your shopping at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app to start saving today. Your cash back really adds up. That's Rakuten.com.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples. Dress listeners, if you suffer from seasonal allergies like me, Astapro is your new go-to. It has been super helpful to me this spring as it bursts into full bloom.
And that's because Astapro is the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter solution for nasal allergy symptoms. Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes while other allergy sprays take hours.
Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray, and Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing. You too can get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief like I have with Astapro. It gets me back in the game, ready to record the show for all of you.
Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can Astapro and go today. That's A-S-T-E-P-R-O allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
So today we've discussed Kimono in Japan, which is just one of the exhibition's three sections. You're going to join us again next week to discuss the other two. So as you've revealed today, the Edo period was an era ripe with artistic inspiration and expression. I mean, perhaps unrivaled in the country's history and undeniably stimulated by the pursuit of fashion. So before we go today, I'm hoping you will share some insight into maybe how you selected garments to feature in this section of the exhibition and perhaps share with us a few of your favorite pieces, although I know that's like asking you to pick between probably your two children, but anyways.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I was saying a minute ago about how amazing they are because they're so varied. To choose to make a selection was really difficult. Of course, we started off with a much greater wish list than we actually ended up with at the end. So we're thinking about particular themes and what story each garment was telling. And I suppose one of the real pleasures really was to go and spend quite a bit of time in Japan with Japanese collections. In Western collections like the V&A and most in the world, you know, you don't get many early Edo period kimono. They tend to be mostly sort of late 18th, 19th century garments. So you need to go to Japan for anything earlier. So it was a real pleasure to be able to see those garments and to talk with curators there. And I learned an awful lot from them. So I think one of my favorite collections is the Joshibi collection, which is not particularly well known perhaps because it's just it's part of an art college, which is just outside Tokyo. So it's not a sort of well-known place, but they have an amazing collection. And I think whenever I did a sort of presentation about the exhibition, everybody's favorite kimono was always the same one, which is actually the first one you see as you go into the exhibition, which is just, it's from about 1800s. It's not that old, but it's very quite modern. It's got this great sweeping stream on it in red, shibori. And then beside it, these very, very beautifully and elegantly embroidered irises. So it sort of sums up that kind of way of using the whole surface of the garment to create this very sort of dramatic kind of design, which looks beautiful both from a distance and very, very close up when you examine it. So that was very beautiful. And another thing from the Joshibi collection, which I was very, very grateful for them to lending to us because it's quite fragile, which is actually a man's garment. So one of the challenges was to find the men because, as I mentioned, it's the women's garments, which are usually the most glamorous and most beautifully decorated, most colourful, and they're the ones that tend to be survived and collected and so on. So finding some men was tricky. We found prints of men and so on, but finding actual garments was quite unusual. But Joshibi had this wonderful one, which is undoubtedly worn by a man, and it has embroidered characters, so embroidered words across the top. Where the mon would normally be, there are paired characters. And quite often you get characters used on women's kimono, which is usually a poem or something like that. But these just read quite simply red hawk, yellow hawk, purple hawk, young hawk, and dancing hawk. And at the bottom of the garment, there's a design of hawks sort of flying around. So you don't really think that this is anything particularly unusual. It's, you know, it seems quite straightforward. But in Japan, in the Edo period, the word hawk was associated with night hawk, which was a euphemism for prostitute. And if you change the syllable or phonetic emphasis of the words for the hawks, you'd get a completely different conversation, effectively, which is between two men talking about going to visit a prostitute. And how much, you know, did they buy it? Did they do it? You know, did you hear about it? So it's quite shocking when you see this, but it's also quite funny. And it really kind of reveals that kind of sort of stylish wit of sort of merchant class taste in the Edo period. So this was definitely a man who was a sort of doyen of what we call the floating world, you know, this world of sort of glamour and eroticism and sensuality that you see very much in the Japanese prints of the time. So it was really lovely to get that one. And then other things were a bit of a surprise. So we visited one particularly wonderful sort of private collector in Kyoto, Kojiro Yoshida. And he also has very unusual things with him, and he produces the kimono that has skeletons on it. And it was just quite a simple produced pattern. It was just stencil produced. But it was like very strange to have a skeleton on the kimono. We couldn't decide whether it be worn by a man or a woman. And we had this wonderful conversation with him about, you know, he would say, oh, it's some sort of disreputable person, you know, a gangster style person who would wear skeletons, you know. But then when I got back to the VNA, I was looking through our print collection that we have, one of the print collection, I came across a print of an actor called Bando Shuka, who was one of these actors who specialised in female roles. And he played one particular role where he was a notorious female thief, and he wore a kimono with skeletons on. So although we don't know for sure that this garment was inspired by that print, I mean, he wasn't the only person to wear skeletons, and it's not the only garment with skeletons on. In fact, I've discovered, but you just sort of think that kind of idea of sort of kabuki actors inspiring fashion, you know, so it's really wonderful to put them on display together in the exhibition. And it's interesting that though, as I say, the techniques on this garment, it's just black with white skeletons, especially. So it's not a particularly, it's not nearly as lavish or as gorgeous as quite a lot of the other garments around, but people love it. You know, visitors to the exhibition really love it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Popular postcards, apparently. So it's very nice. And he was very pleased when he came to see him. He'd lent this garment to us, but he was so happy with how it looked. He's actually gifted it to us. So that's very kind of him. So.
I mean, yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because it's graphically so captivating and stunning. It definitely is one of my favorite pieces as well.
Yeah.
Anna, thank you so much for being here today. It has been such a treat. Thank you for coming to share your incredible work and research with us. And you'll be back joining us next week for part two. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
April, as you know, as soon as I heard this exhibition was on its way to the V&A, I immediately pre-ordered the catalog. And let me assure you, dress listeners, you are going to want to get your hands on it too.
Yes, because it has a plethora of wonderful essays from different scholars and experts in the field and features over 250 garments. We will, of course, be posting some of these images on our Instagram feed to accompany this week's episode, but there's also just so much more in the catalog.
Yeah, and if you cannot get a copy of the catalog, we will, of course, provide a link in our show notes to the exhibition's website, which has many wonderful features, including a selection of highlighted objects from the exhibition and an inside look at the exhibition itself. And I have to say, as a huge fan of Japanese fashion, I truly cannot say enough wonderful things about this exhibition and the scholarship it presents in regards to the Japanese fashion system.
That, I think, does it for us today, dress listeners. Please tune in next week for part two of our interview with curator Anna Jackson, where we discuss the global influence of the kimono into the 19th, 20th, and 21st centuries. Until then, may you consider the kimono's legacy next time you get dressed.
And of course, remember to tune in this Thursday for the latest edition of Fashion History Now, where we discuss what is happening in the world of fashion history today. We love hearing from you, so if you'd like to email us, please do so at dressed@iheartmedia.com.
You can also direct message us on Instagram at @dressed_podcast, where you will find images accompanying each week's episode. You can also direct message us on Instagram at @dressed_podcast, where you will find images accompanying each week's episode. You can also follow us on Facebook at @dresspodcast without the underscore.
And as always, special thanks to our producers, Casey Pegram, Holly Fry, and everyone else at iHeartRadio who makes this show possible each and every week.
Catch you Thursday. Dress, the History of Fashion, is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen to your favorite shows.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.